Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome again to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Kevin Camps, a radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, an organization based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Kevin addresses the safety and security risks of high-level radioactive waste storage on-site at nuclear power plants. He also campaigns about the economic, environmental, and public health risks associated with government and industry efforts to dump commercial irradiated fuel rods on Native American lands in the western United States, particularly on western Shoshone Indian land at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. Kevin has testified before officials, the highest levels of the U.S. federal agencies, charged with radioactive waste mismanagement, including the Department of Energy, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the Environmental Protection Agency. In spring 2007, he was featured in national print and broadcast media here in Australia during a month-long countrywide speaking tour. Kevin Camps has spoken at the National Press Club in Washington, as well as the Press Club of the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa. Kevin, welcome to the program, and it looks like you're an extremely busy man.
Thanks, Ellen. It's an honor to be on your show.
It's an honor to have you on the show. Kevin, look, there are many things happening at the moment, and people should know that this is a taped broadcast, so it won't be in real time. It'll be retrospective. But why don't you give us a list of the major issues that are occurring right now, both internationally and nationally?
Well, there's a lot going on, as you say, and it's because the Bush administration, which is one of the most pro-nuclear in U.S. history, is going for broke in its last few months. So they're trying to do as many favors as possible for their friends and contributors, campaign contributors in the nuclear power industry. So as we speak, today we are facing nuclear power subsidies on the floor of the United States Senate, and we're talking to the tune of tens to hundreds of billions of dollars in proposed subsidies. This is a part of the so-called Lieberman-Warner climate change bill, which used to be called the McCain-Lieberman climate change bill, but McCain is busy on the campaign trail for president of the United States. Another big development is that just yesterday, the U.S. Department of Energy applied to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a license to build and operate the Yucca Mountain, Nevada high-level radioactive waste dump. So one way to look at that one is that's been 20 years in the making. That's how long Yucca Mountain has been singled out for this dump site. But you could also look at it as 50 years in the making, because the U.S. federal government made its incredible, absurd, unprecedented promise to the nuclear power industry 50 years ago in 1957 that it would take care of its high-level radioactive wastes. So that application was just filed yesterday. Another one that's just come to our attention in the last few hours is that there seems to have been a nuclear incident in Slovenia.
Don't say incident, Kevin. Say accident.
Ellen, I have to challenge your use of accident, because 50 years into the nuclear power age, how can we call these things accidents anymore? If we're willing to take these risks with the technology, it's almost not an accident anymore. It's a calculated gamble that sometimes goes wrong.
The engineers say everything's perfect, you know.
So I agree with you. it appears to be a somewhat significant accident today, because the European Union has alerted all 27 of its member countries. It's an emergency alert system having to do with nuclear power. So phrases like loss of coolant in the primary circuit have been used, which is very disconcerting.
What date is it today, Kevin?
Today is June 4th.
All right. Tell us what loss of coolant in the primary circuit means, so people can understand the potential gravity of this situation.
Right, and we are waiting for further details as to what's going on. But what loss of coolant can mean is that water in the primary coolant loop of a pressurized water reactor, which is what the Krisko reactor in Slovenia is, a pressurized water reactor. A loss of coolant means that the reactor core itself becomes uncovered, so a loss of water over the nuclear fuel in the core. In a very short matter of time after you lose coolant over the reactor core, you can have a meltdown because the nuclear fuel is so exceedingly hot that it actually melts down. And this is what happened at Three Mile Island in 1979, a loss of coolant to the reactor core and a 50% meltdown of the reactor core at Three Mile Island. So it's a very serious matter, and I'm hoping that it was a translation error, but we will see what is actually going on in Slovenia today.
Well, I wouldn't think it was a translation error, because if they've alerted the other 27 countries of the EU, it means that probably there's something significant going on, and I agree, we'll find out. But
yeah.
Translocate that to Chernobyl, although there was an explosion there, I know, and they lost the roof of the reactor and the whole thing, but huge amounts of radiation got out. Just for a moment, let's fantasize if, in fact, there is a meltdown in the reactor at Slovenia. What would that mean to the surrounding populations?
Well, a loss of coolant accident and a meltdown of the core can very easily lead to a catastrophic radioactivity release from a nuclear power plant. The only barrier remaining after a meltdown is the containment building of the reactor itself. And if the meltdown proceeds to melt through the concrete foundations and into the groundwater supply below of the Earth itself, you could have steam explosions and just a massive release of radioactivity into the surrounding air.
Bursting the containment vessel, right?
That's a worst-case scenario, but it's all too possible. It's a risk that we run every single day at all of the 450 nuclear power plants in the world.
Okay, now describe what would happen to the surrounding population and what isotopes would be released, radioactive elements. Kevin?
Yes, well, if you have a loss of containment due to a meltdown, you're going to have even the so-called short-lived radioactive poisons escaping, and you're also going to have radioactive poisons like radioactive cesium-137, radioactive strontium-90, plutonium-239. These were the poisons that escaped during the Chernobyl nuclear catastrophe, and to this day, here we are, over 20 years later, contaminating the environment, contaminating the food supply, the water supply, for hundreds of miles downwind and downstream in very serious health-damaging concentrations. So the Chernobyl disaster is an all-too-clear warning to humankind about what a nuclear disaster looks like, and that's why we need to phase out nuclear power.
Well, there are thousands of people, as we know, developing leukemia, thyroid cancer, other cancers, babies being born mentally deformed and physically deformed around Chernobyl and downwind for hundreds or thousands of miles. And what else would happen if this, in fact, induces a meltdown in Slovenia is that those short-lived radioactive materials that you talked about, Kevin, are extraordinarily radioactive. And if you're immersed in a cloud of these radioactive gases, you get such a huge dose of radiation, you develop acute radiation illness, whereby the actively dividing cells of your body die and your hair falls out. In a few days, you start vomiting and developing diarrhea, and then you start bleeding to death. Three phases, you know, the acute radiation sickness, the leukemia, the cancers, and the deformities and genetic diseases.
Well, I should hasten to add that the reports coming out, and I've seen the Reuters coverage, the AFP, Agence France-Presse, and even the Associated Press here, and so far the authorities in Slovenia are claiming that no radioactivity has escaped. So just the use of the phrase loss of coolant accident is what caused me such alarm today.
And how long would it take, say there was a loss of coolant, and say they can't stabilize the situation, from, you know, how many hours would it be, Kevin, what's your assessment, before there was a release of radiation?
The meltdown could begin in a matter of just a few hours. The fuel is so hot. And then what would then have to happen is for the containment building of the reactor itself to fail. So these kinds of meltdowns and catastrophic releases could just take a matter of hours from start to finish.
Right. So we're sitting on a potential time bomb. And when people listen to this, obviously we'll all know about it, and hopefully it was nothing of great significance. But if it was, people will listen and know that we were predicting these occurrences. So that's an interesting foundation upon which to base this interview, Kevin. And today I'm speaking to Kevin Camps, who's a radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, an organization which opposes both nuclear power and nuclear weapons, which is wonderful. I'd like now to move on to this bill that is being debated in the Senate. And it was called the McCain-Lieberman bill, and now it's called the Lieberman-Warner bill. And I know that Barbara Boxer, who's a Democrat from California, is also involved and is seriously opposed to nuclear power and seriously in favour of renewable energy. So tell us who wrote this bill and what are the major elements of the bill so we can understand what on earth is going on.
Okay. Well, this is a major piece of climate change legislation. It's called Senate Bill 3036 at this point.
Yeah.
Securing America's Climate Act is what they're calling it, America's Climate Security Act. So it was originally written several years ago in a past version by John McCain, the Republican of Arizona, who's running for president, and he was joined by Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, who at that time was a Democrat.
And is now an independent, right?
That's
but
right.
He's really a Republican.
Yes, well, at this point, that's very true. And
yeah.
5 years ago or more, when they first introduced this bill, when they put nuclear power subsidies in it, they actually lost several votes, including Barbara Boxer's, as you mentioned. And a lot has changed in 5 years. McCain's running for president, and Lieberman is so-called an independent, but he's really working closely with Republicans and with McCain at this point. Barbara Boxer, the Democrat from California, is now the chairwoman of the Environment and Public Works Committee, which is quite an interesting development in the Senate. That's
yep.
right. And this bill has come out of her committee. It has the names of Lieberman and Warner on it as the primary sponsors. John Warner is a retiring Republican from Virginia. And
previously married to Elizabeth Taylor.
Yes, and he's best known for his military
record.
Senate Armed Services Committee membership.
Yep.
So so this bill is a major climate change bill. Friends of the Earth did an analysis last fall when it came out of committee and put a round number of $5 trillion in economic value on this bill. That's with a TR, trillion. And what it does is it tries to reduce global warming's emissions by the year 2050 by 60% instead of 80%.
That's hopeless. That means the Earth is doomed. If we just reduce it to 60% in the U.S. Yeah, go on.
Well, the part of the bill that I've been most focused on is a sneak attack to try to secure hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies at taxpayer expense for the nuclear power industry.
All right. Now, how can that have happened in Barbara Boxer's committee? That's what I don't understand, Kevin. What is going
on? To be fair to her, if the nuclear power subsidies become too extreme and too excessive, she will probably pull the bill from the Senate floor. But in the interim, in her efforts to try to pass climate change legislation, given the impending crisis that we face as a humankind, she has gone along with some of the proposals that Lieberman and Warner have floated, and those have only been recently made publicly available to look at.
And what are they? You tell us.
Yes, they include several proposals for nuclear power subsidies, including paying for the training of nuclear engineers, paying for the training of nuclear security guards, paying for the training of nuclear grade workers, such as nuclear welders and other nuclear power plant construction experts, including management to oversee the building of nuclear power plants. So talk of funding those, and a little bit more ambiguous, but just you wait until they get behind closed doors, talk of paying for the reestablishment of an infrastructure to build large nuclear components in the United States, reactor pressure vessels, steam generators. This industry, nuclear component manufacturer, ceased to exist in the United States over two decades ago because nuclear had failed so miserably in the marketplace. the only place in the world that can build such large components for nuclear reactors is in Japan, at Japan Steelworks, and there's a three-year waiting list there. So in one fell swoop, the champions of nuclear power in the U.S. Senate are trying to subsidize the reestablishment of that industry.
Well, and how did I really, it's beyond my capacity to imagine how Barbara Boxer, who I know and really respect, allowed this to happen.
Well, it just gets to the heart. I mean, there's kind of a stark choice that Senator Boxer and others are facing. If they wish to debate climate change on the Senate floor and try to do something about it, there are forces in the Senate, and too many of them, unfortunately, sitting in the Senate right now that are demanding subsidies for their favorite industry, the nuclear power industry, in order to even engage in this debate. And as we speak, it's being debated. There are a lot of senators who just want to kill this bill because they don't think there's a problem. You know, Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma calls the climate crisis the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people.
Oh, how ignorant.
He's the ranking Republican on the Environment and Public Works Committee, so you can see the dire straits we're in.
Oh my God! What really takes my breath away, Kevin, is the appalling scientific illiteracy of many of these people, in whose hands rests the fate of the Earth, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I've just been reading the IPCC report, the International Panel on Climate Change, and James Hansen's reports from NASA about global warming. We're beyond the tipping point right now. The Arctic ice sheet is melting. We've gone up 0.8 degrees centigrade, I think it's centigrade, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, I think. And already it's set to go up another 0.5 degrees, whatever we do, which will initiate, too, the melting of the Greenland ice cap. And if that happens, the oceans could rise 23 feet. And maybe I've got that wrong, but some enormous number. And yet we've got these, I have to say, idiots in the Senate, and we've got people here in Australia too, probably not as many as you, who would deny that global warming is actually occurring and being induced by human beings. I mean...
And so cynically, I mean, maybe that's what the C stands for in Washington, D.C., is a district of cynicism or corruption. The pro-nuclear senators are really holding hostage this climate change bill unless they get, you know, money and big money for their favorite industry.
So... The next question is, these pro-nuclear senators, how much money did they receive and have they received from the nuclear power industry for their campaigns?
Massive amounts. Massive. The nuclear power industry is one of the biggest players in town in Washington, D.C. in terms of presidential and congressional campaign contributions.
So where does the nuclear power industry get its money from, Kevin?
Yeah, well, there are the reactor designers like General Electric and Westinghouse, and then there's the reactor builders like Bechtel and Stone and Webster and other engineering firms. And then there's the nuclear utilities themselves like Southern Company and Detroit Edison. The biggest ones are Exelon, based in Chicago, which is a union of the Chicago-based and Philadelphia-based nuclear utilities. And then there's Entergy, Dominion. These are the names of the different nuclear utilities. So the reason that they're so wealthy and rolling in dough is because a lot of the costs, most of the costs, have been borne by taxpayers and ratepayers. This is the most heavily subsidized industry in the energy sector in the United States. And we can talk more about that. Taking care of the radioactive waste is an incredible promise the U.S. government made. That's a pretty huge subsidy. And at the same time as they're heavily subsidized, these reactors do make a lot of electricity, and the nuclear utilities especially are profiting to the tune of, on average, $1 million a day in an operating reactor. So they pocket the profit, and then they turn around and they charge U.S. ratepayers and taxpayers for such things as the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump that's proposed in Nevada. And the DOE has just recently admitted its current estimate of the price tag for Yucca Mountain to be $70 to $80 billion is the subsidy that ratepayers and taxpayers are footing for the nuclear power industry here.
Well, Kevin, on a previous note, the truth is, and we know this, and probably not many of the senators do, that nuclear power in its own right produces massive quantities of global warming gases, because you have to dig up millions of tons of uranium ore, you have to crush it, you have to enrich it. And in America, you use two huge 1,500 megawatt coal-fired plants to enrich the uranium. And that's just the front end of the fuel cycle, let alone carrying and transportation of radioactive waste for the next 500,000 years. So if you add all of that up, the figures currently are that a nuclear power plant operating produces 30% of the CO2 as a similar-sized gas-fired plant, but as the uranium ore declines in concentration and grade over the next 10 or 20 years, the nuclear power plant will produce the same amount of CO2 as the gas-fired plant. So, in truth, these senators either are lying or they've been sold a bill of goods by the nuclear power industry to say, you know, nuclear power is clean, cheap, and produces no emissions.
Right, and the Nuclear Energy Institute shamefully runs TV and radio and newspaper ads here that claim that it is emissions-free, but as you described, it is not global warming gas emissions-free by any means. And then add to that the radioactive waste for which we have no solution and the unaddressed and unsolved risks such as safety and security risks and the routine releases of radioactivity on a daily basis at these plants.
Well, you know, Kevin is a nuclear radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, a wonderful organization actually that I helped establish. But, you know, Kevin, these people have huge amounts of money and they're absolutely deluging the American public with lies in their propaganda efforts. And they use Helen Knowlton, a propaganda company, which told everyone that tobacco doesn't cause cancer. So we're into the same sort of story again. Nuclear power is safe, clean, and cheap. How can we make you a star of stage, green, and radio, Kevin? You're a very beautiful, handsome-looking fellow.
Why, thank you very much.
How can we make you, you know, a really major anti-nuclear rock star and get you everywhere? I mean, that's what we need to do. How can we suddenly turn the media on to you, Kevin?
Well, I was lucky enough to be invited by the Wilderness Society to Australia just over a year ago, and I did get a lot of media over there, and it really felt good because, unfortunately, a part of the nightmare with nuclear power in the United States is that the media just ignores the issue for the most part. So there's been very little to no coverage of these proposed nuclear power subsidies in this bill thus far, and try as we might. Luckily, and I'm very happy about this, some of the major environmental groups have joined with groups like ours just today, the Union of Concerned Scientists and Natural Resources Defense Council have spoken out against nuclear power subsidies in this bill. And I just wanted to, you know, kind of let people know that there are groups that are feeling so divided on this issue because the climate crisis is staring us in the face, and the only way it seems to move it in the Senate is to at least flirt with the idea of subsidies for nuclear power. So I'm very pleased that NRDC and UCS have joined now other environmental groups saying no nuclear subsidies in this legislation.
Well, Kevin, one last question. Don't you have an organization for fair and honest advertising? And is it the FCC? And I believe someone's gone to the FCC to say that the nuclear power industry and the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is its propaganda arm, are lying about, you know, saying it's clean, cheap, and no emissions. Has Beyond Nuclear or, you know, NRDC could do this, Natural Resources Defense Council or the Union of Concerned Scientists. We need to appeal to that body to say you can't have dishonest advertising.
That's right. About 10 years ago, the Safe Energy Communications Council was successful before the Federal Trade Commission here as well as the Better Business Bureau in slamming the Nuclear Energy Institute for false advertising.
Yeah.
And it looks like we're going to have to do that same struggle all over again.
So they didn't pull their heads in at the time.
Well, they did, but it was 10 years ago, and now that's slipping. They're trying ever more to present themselves as the solution to the climate crisis.
Oh, my God. Well, look, let's move on then. We need to move on, I think, to Yucca Mountain. Just give us Kevin, who's Kevin Camps, a wonderful specialist in radioactive waste. Can you just give us a potted history of Yucca, when it started, what the government promised to the utilities who ran nuclear power plants, how much nuclear waste a nuclear power plant produces every year, how long it lasts, and what they promised that they would do with, the government promised they would do with it, and when.
Okay. Well, it goes back to the very beginning of the nuclear power industry in the U.S. Back in 1957, the first plant was built at Shippingport, Pennsylvania, and it was the same year that the federal government told the utility companies, hey, we'll take care of your waste for you, your high-level radioactive waste. And they also said, we'll take care of your liability in case of a major accident. So the Price-Anderson Act was passed in 1957. So that was a big year. And what then happened was it took some time, but in 1983, the Nuclear Waste Policy Act was passed, where they tried to codify this promise into law. And at that point, there was a site selection process put in motion, and they were looking for the best geological sites in the country, supposedly. Well, fast forward to 1987, and politics completely trumped science, and an amendment to that bill was passed, which is affectionately known to this day as the Screw Nevada Bill. Nevada was a state of low population, and it was singled out by other states like Texas and Washington State with much bigger populations, much bigger congressional delegations, as just a great place to study for nuclear waste disposal. And it happened in 2002 that the George W. Bush administration gave its thumbs up to the Yucca Mountain site as suitable. And this was when 300 key technical scientific studies were still incomplete at the site. So politics completely trumped science. And just yesterday, the Department of Energy, and this is almost 6 years late at this point, filed its license application to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to construct and open a national dump site at Yucca Mountain. There is a legal limit for how much waste could be buried at Yucca Mountain, a limit of 63,000 tons of commercial high-level nuclear waste. And the reason for that is the law says that a second dump site somewhere else in the country, in the eastern United States, where 75% of the reactors are located, must be opened first before more waste than 63,000 tons could be dumped at Yucca. That magic number of 63,000 tons will exist in the U.S. by the spring of 2010. So everything generated after the spring of 2010 would be excess to Yucca's capacity to accept it. And I should hasten to add that Yucca is geologically unsuitable for nuclear waste disposal. It's an active earthquake zone. It's a volcanic area, and there's a drinking water supply located beneath the mountain. A farming community downstream already uses that water for irrigation. And in addition to all that, we shouldn't even be looking at that site because it's Western Shoshone Indian land by the Treaty of Ruby Valley, which the U.S. government signed in 1863. And they sure don't want this most deadly poison ever generated. It's a incredible environmental justice violation going on. It's radioactive racism. But scientifically, the site is, according to Dr. Arjun Makajani at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, he considers it the worst site ever studied for a nuclear waste disposal site here in the United States.
The whole thing just takes my breath away. I mean, how many shipments of radioactive waste would have to occur every year through the towns and cities and highways and railways of America to Yucca Mountain to dispose of the radioactive waste by 2010, and for how many years? How many shipments a year and for how many years?
Okay. Well, the Department of Energy is now saying that the best achievable date that they could open Yucca is the year 2020, because they have to go through a four-year Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensing proceeding, and then they'd have to build the dump. And that would include building a transportation route within Nevada, because there's no rail route out to Yucca Mountain. They've chosen mostly rail as their preferred shipping mode. So we're talking a ballpark figure of about 10,000 shipments to get all these rail casks out to Yucca. These are over 100 tons in weight. And there are some reactors in the United States, about 25, that lack rail access. And so they would either have to barge these very heavy rail casks on the Great Lakes, the seacoasts, the rivers, to get them to the nearest railhead, or else they'd have to use trucks on the highways, smaller containers on trucks. So we could also see thousands of truck shipments. So we're really talking every week a few of these rail shipments crossing the United States through as many as 45 states. There's very few states that would be spared these shipments by rail. And if trucks are involved, that would implicate even more states. And the significance is that these shipments of very deadly material would be passing through major population centers, cities like Chicago, So we're talking many thousands, perhaps even tens of thousands of shipments. And DOE's best achievable transport plan would take 25 years to get these wastes out there. And that's just the way it's generated up until 2010. So anything generated after 2010 would require a second dump and an additional shipments.
So isn't it about 1,500 shipments a year?
Yeah, the number keeps fluctuating depending on which shipment scenario they would use. But if they use rail shipments, you're right, it would be several hundred to 1,500 shipments per year.
So what do you call Nevada, the screw Nevada bill? This one's been dumped, the Mobile Chernobyl bill, right?
Well, the reason for the name Mobile Chernobyl is that these shipping containers are not impervious to severe accident scenarios. So, for example, there was a fire in a train tunnel under Baltimore here in Maryland in the year 2001, and the state of Nevada did a study asking what if high-level radioactive waste had been on board that train. This fire burned in a tunnel beneath downtown Baltimore for several days at very high temperatures, and wouldn't you know it, it is a targeted Department of Energy transport route to Yucca Mountain. And the Nevada study found that the shipping container would have breached and radioactivity would have escaped volatile radioactive poisons like the radioactive cesiums. And the casualty figures that Nevada came up with were scores of latent cancer fatalities that were unavoidable. And if people continued to live in the contamination in downtown Baltimore for a year, then the number of latent cancer fatalities would increase to about 1,500. And then if people continued to live in contaminated areas for 50 years, the latent cancer fatalities would top 30,000. And it sounds kind of far-fetched to think that people would be allowed to live in contaminated areas for 50 years. But just a couple years ago, the Bush administration's Department of Homeland Security published a draft cleanup standard for dirty bomb radiological attacks here in the United States. And they thought that a 10 rem per year cleanup level would be sufficient. So fortunately, groups across the country rallied and prevented that standard from being finalized, but a 10 rem per year cleanup standard would allow for a 1 in 4 cancer rate for people living in that kind of radioactivity for a lifetime. So you can see, you know, with such high possible casualty rates at Baltimore, that these shipments are potentially catastrophic accident risks, and then there's the risk of terrorist attacks that intentionally target these shipments.
Of course. I mean, it's a moving terrorist target. They'll be moving terrorists. The whole thing is a nightmare almost beyond anything that you could ever dream about. And we've known about this for so long, and yet the politicians and the industry put blinders on like a horse so that you can't see in your peripheral vision what really is the truth and what really will be the ramifications, not just for this generation, but all future generations from the waste. Inducing epidemics of malignancy forevermore and genetic disease. That's really what we're talking about. And, you know, Kevin, I compare the nuclear industry to the tobacco industry. You know those 8 men that stood before Congress with their hands on their hearts saying that tobacco didn't cause cancer? I'll never forget that. And then we've got the nuclear industry absolutely denying that they're going to cause cancer. But, you see, smoking only kills the smoker. But nuclear power and the waste from the nuclear industry will not only affect this generation, but more will affect all future generations. So we're leaving a legacy, a public health problem for the rest of time, not just for our species, but all other species, because they get cancer too and have genetic disease. That's the legacy that nuclear power means. And we've known that forever. It really does take my breath away that how can it possibly be going on still?
And we've talked about the risks of catastrophes like meltdowns or accidents with shipments, but another issue that often is downplayed, especially by the authorities who are supposed to protect us, is the issue of routine radioactivity releases into the environment. And we've seen tritium releases in 98 of the 103 nuclear power plants across the United States, releases into groundwater that were unintentional. And then if you count the intentional releases, because they intentionally discharge tritium every day, that's all of the reactors, and especially up in Canada, like at the Bruce Nuclear Complex on Lake Huron.
Yeah, look, just briefly say why tritium is so dangerous and what its half-life is, Kevin. Give people just a little picture of tritium.
Well, tritium is radioactive hydrogen, and it has a hazardous half-life of 12.3 years, so you got to multiply by at least 10, so that's 120 years of hazardous persistence. And it is released routinely from nuclear power plants. The Canadian so-called CANDU reactors are especially bad at generating tritium mm-hmm. and releasing it. And the danger is, especially if it binds organically into your body, that it can do its damage there. It's a beta particle emitter, and it can integrate into the human system at the most intimate levels,
into
right
the
down
DNA
to the DNA.
Molecule.
That's
yeah.
right. So mm-hmm. it can do damage to the person exposed, and it can also do damage to the genetic material.
And cause cancer and fetal abnormalities, you name it. And each reactor
yep.
routinely emits it into the air and water every second of every day, right?
And there, yes, that's right. And in Illinois, here in the U.S., which has the most operating reactors, there's 11 operating reactors and three shutdown ones, there is a scandal that has yet to get sufficient coverage by any means in the media. A cancer cluster, brain cancer cases in children in Morris, Illinois, led an angry mom to start asking questions about what is in the water. Mm. She did a Freedom of Information Act request against the state of Illinois Environmental Protection Agency and uncovered a 10-year-old cover-up of massive tritium releases into the groundwater. We're talking millions of gallons of tritium.
These people are criminals.
Yeah, and so she uncovered the truth, and we're still trying hard to, you know, they're denying, the industry denies that there's any link between the brain cancer cluster and children.
They wouldn't know. They're not doctors.
Releases.
They're not pathologists. They're not, I mean, they don't know what they're talking about. They're
yeah.
engineers. They're businessmen or physicists, but they don't understand medicine or pathophysiology. So how can they possibly deny it? Because they don't know.
It's very telling that they found it necessary to cover up the truth for 10 years until,
yeah.
you know, a single concerned mother uncovered it.
Yeah, like it's like Nixon saying, I'm not a crook.
Yeah, it's really, it's an Aaron Brockovich kind of story. The mom's yeah. name is Cynthia Sauer, and her daughter is named Sarah, and mm. she contracted brain cancer at age 7, and it's yeah. thankfully in remission, but other children in the community haven't been that lucky. And there's other maladies besides brain cancer in children. There's heart pathology, a lot of rare diseases that have turned up in Morris, Illinois.
Mm.
And the people of Morris were really kept in the dark. The doctors in Chicago knew that something was going on because all the kids would go there for special treatment.
Mm.
And this it took this mom to organize her community and get the truth out.
Yeah,
so,
it always yeah. does that, you know.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Kevin Camps, who's a specialist in radioactive waste in the United States and works for a wonderful organization called Beyond Nuclear in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Now, okay, so talking about tritium, let's get on to this horrific situation that's occurring near Toronto with the reactors there at Bruce and right on the lake. Just give us a sort of a potted story about what's happening there, Kevin.
Well, the Bruce Nuclear Complex is the largest single nuclear power plant in North America, and now they're proposing new reactors, so it could become the biggest nuclear power plant in the whole world.
How many have they got there now?
Altogether, there are 9 reactors
nine.
At this site. There's one shutdown prototype. There's 8 CANDU reactors, a few of which are also shut down for safety violations. But
yeah.
if they were all operating, that would be 8. And then they're proposing 4 new ones. And it's one of 3 nuclear power plants in Ontario, which has 20 reactors altogether. The other 2, Darlington and Pickering, are closer to Toronto. Those are to the east of Toronto. Bruce is a long distance to the west of Toronto. It's right on the Lake Huron shore, and so that puts it just 50 miles across Lake Huron from Michigan in the United States. And a recent proposal that's really raised the ire of Michiganders is a proposal to bury all of Ontario's so-called low and intermediate level radioactive wastes just 1 kilometer from the shore of Lake Huron. So this is 20 reactors worth of so-called low and intermediate level radioactive wastes. And we have been afraid, since hearing that proposal, that this was really just a foot in the door to make Bruce the high-level radioactive waste storage site for all of Ontario. And we've seen some more evidence in just the last week or two that indicates that may be in the offing. They're really getting away with murder at Bruce. It's a remote location far from any major cities. Detroit is downstream and other Michigan communities that get their drinking water out of the Great Lakes. So we're trying to raise the level of awareness and concern on the U.S. side. But Another incredible thing that's gone on at Bruce for a very long time, actually, is the incineration of these low-level so-called radioactive waste.
Are they burning them?
Yes, most of the so-called low-level radioactive waste in Ontario are being incinerated at the Bruce complex.
Well, tell people what low-level radioactive wastes are, Kevin.
Well, really, it's a less concentrated form of the same poisons found in high-level radioactive waste.
Yeah, but in what form? You know, old gloves and, you know...
Well, it can take on many forms, you're right. It can be the clothing, the protective clothing and gloves and clean-up materials like mops and towels that are used at the nuclear power plant. But it also refers to such things as filters on the cooling water and cooling systems of nuclear power reactors themselves, as well as the waste storage pools.
That filter out the radioactive waste. So then they burn them.
They burn them.
And the radioactive elements go straight into the air. I mean, how dare they? What?
Well, they do have filters, but you can imagine that a lot is not captured by the filters. And so the filters are also incinerated at this facility.
I bet no one's done an epidemiological study of people living around those or near those reactors or downwind from them to see if there's an elevated level of cancers amongst that population.
You're right about that lack of epidemiological studies. I don't know of any. And then, in addition, there's very little monitoring that seems to be done on the emissions themselves.
Is it in a sort of relatively rural farming area? Are they growing food there?
Yes, it is. It's agricultural, and it's actually a very beautiful place. It's right next to the Georgian Bay on Lake Huron. It's wilderness in other regards, except that one of the largest nuclear power plants on Earth is incinerating radioactive waste up there. And in addition, to the north, a few hundred miles, are the Elliott Lake uranium mines in Ontario, which are releasing such things as radium into Lake Huron on an ongoing basis.
And what food do they grow there? Is it wheat?
You know, I'm not sure.
Yeah, we need to find that out.
I know that there's a sheep farm in the vicinity. That's one of the local anti-nuclear activists operates a sheep farm.
Be interesting to see what sort of radioactive iodine the sheep have in their thyroid glands and how much cesium they have in their meat and muscle and strontium in their bones and the whole... I mean, this thing... Now, if you could mobilize the senators, the congresspeople from Michigan, and the mayors of Detroit and other major cities there, what influence then would the Michigan delegation have upon the Canadian government?
Well, we've already had some success. We got Congressman Bart Stupak of Michigan, who's pretty high up in the Congress and has oversight on nuclear matters on the mm-hmm. U.S. side, to mm-hmm. make some noise, because he is the congressman from that district that's just 50 miles across the lake. Mm. And the success that we gained by alerting him and getting him activated is that the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission has agreed very reluctantly to do a high-level environmental review. It's called a full panel review on this proposal. And we had to really drag them kicking and screaming to do that. We had a lot of help from our Canadian colleagues, like with Greenpeace Canada. Unfortunately, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission is now trying to undermine the process. They're trying to involve themselves in this so-called independent panel review, and they have shown their bias all too clearly for decades, that they want to rubber stamp any nuclear proposal that comes their way. So now we're fighting and trying to get help from elected officials in the U.S. to prevent that from happening and try to make sure that this is an independent panel that reviews this proposal.
I would think that you need to get the Senate delegation from Michigan, you know, number one, and number two, you need to get the congressional delegation and the various mayors of the major cities. This could be a sort of a prototype action of a government against another government, which doesn't often happen. But, you know, there are no boundaries when it comes to nuclear power meltdowns, as we well know.
Yeah, and we've been working for a very long time with a body called the International Joint Commission, which is a joint U.S.-Canadian federal panel that's established 100 years ago to protect the waters of the Great Lakes. And we've had some success there. Dr. Rosalie Bertel was on a nuclear task force of the International Joint Commission. And actually, the International Joint Commission called for the elimination of radioactive discharges into the Great Lakes. They also called for elimination of toxic chemical discharges into the Great Lakes. Mm. The unfortunate thing is that both federal governments have largely ignored the recommendations of this body that was mandated with protecting the Great Lakes.
I'm interviewing Kevin Camps, who's a wonderful radioactive waste specialist who works at Beyond Nuclear, another wonderful organization. based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. If you want more information, what's the website for Beyond Nuclear, Kevin?
Yeah, it's just simply www.beyondnuclear.org.
Right. You know, often in my most depressed, cynical, and pessimistic moods, I think that the only way we can stop this dastardly industry is for another major meltdown to occur. Do you tend to agree with that, Kevin? How do we shock the world into understanding?
Well, I hear what you're saying, but as you know better than anyone, people around the world have devoted their lives to trying to prevent that from happening. And so it's really the job of Beyond Nuclear and so many other groups here in the U.S. and in other countries just to, you know, tirelessly work to prevent that nightmare from happening ever again. And we've had it happen so many times already. I mean, Chernobyl is at the top of the list, but there are so many lesser-known nuclear accidents and radioactivity releases that have already occurred, and we just have to prevent them from happening anymore. So we need to abolish nuclear power. We need to abolish nuclear weapons, and it deserves a place in the dustbin of history. But we are left with the forever deadly radioactive wastes that have been generated. And you had asked how long they're deadly for. Well, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has proposed Yucca radiation release regulations that recognize that these wastes will remain hazardous for a million years into the future. That's a proposal. They are also, unfortunately, under the Bush administration's pressure, proposing a really dastardly standard. Even though they recognize the hazard, they're proposing to allow future generations to receive as much as 350 millirem per year of a median radiation dose from leakage from the Yucca Mountain dump. And if you look at the fine print in their regulations, they would allow some people to receive as much as 2 rem per year in radiation doses leaking from the mountain. And that adds up to something like a 1 in 30 cancer rate and a 1 in 70 fatal cancer rate for people living downwind and downstream of Yucca Mountain.
Yes, it's terribly serious. But don't forget, we're going to get a new president in November, and hopefully it'll be a president who has an open mind, although we're not too sure where Obama stands on nuclear power because he's funded by the industry. But I want to move on now and talk about your reception, Kevin, in Australia. We're taping this interview actually early in the morning in a studio in Canberra, Australia, which is the capital city of Australia. Mm-hmm. We have 40% of the world's richest uranium in Australia. I believe we export it to America as well as many other countries. Tell us what your impression was, A, of Australia, B, how well you were received, and C, what you learned about Australian uranium and what we're doing here.
Well, I was sponsored to come over by the Wilderness Society of Australia in March of 2007, and the context was that the federal elections were impending that November, and the Conservative government was enamored with the Bush administration's global nuclear energy partnership. And so the Wilderness Society wanted me to come over and share with Australian audiences and the media there the reality of the global nuclear energy partnership, as well as the reality of radioactive waste in the United States. And I was on the road for about 4 weeks, and I went from Queensland. I went all over the country to all the major cities. I didn't make it up to the Northern Territory or to Tasmania, but those were the only places I didn't go. I went to the rest of the capital cities, and I was very warmly received all over the place with really great turnouts and a lot of interest. And I was, very excited that the pro-nuclear agenda of the Conservative Party was not, made into reality. But I was concerned when I learned that even the Labor government has yet to withdraw from the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. So you really put your finger on it. I mean, all the talk of new reactors and an international waste dump in Australia and uranium enrichment, those kind of things seem to fall by the wayside with the election results. But unfortunately, the uranium mining seems to be proceeding, gung-ho into the future, and with all the attendant risks to the environment and even to nuclear weapons proliferation. But to answer your question about my impressions, Australia is the most beautiful place I've ever been to, and the uranium mining threatens that beauty. and that biological diversity. And of course, nuclear power cannot by any means solve the climate crisis, so that also threatens Australia, the climate crisis does, with irreparable harm. And we need to solve the climate crisis with the real solutions like energy efficiency and renewable sources of electricity and transport fuel. Things like wind power and solar power are the real answers, and nuclear power is just a disaster of a dead end. We'll waste a lot of money, we'll waste a lot of time, we'll generate a lot of radioactive waste, and we'll take all these risks of meltdowns and terrorist attacks and even nuclear weapons proliferation if we go down that path.
Yes, well, you know, Australia is really just one big desert with a few cities on the periphery of the desert. And we're perfectly placed to become the energy superpower of the world for solar power, for wind power, for hot rock electricity generation. And unfortunately, our new Prime Minister called Kevin Rudd, who's the head of the Labor Party here, like your Democrats, is in the pocket of the coal industry. And Australia's got huge amounts of coal. Typically, I look out from my window into the harbour and see 15 huge tankers waiting to go and be loaded up with coal to take it to China. And that's almost a Jungian anagram of where the world is at the moment, because it's coal that is producing a large part of the CO2 global warming gas. And China's just gone burko in terms of burning coal. And we're supplying the coal, and we also have a huge amount of uranium. And our Prime Minister's in the pocket of the nuclear industry and really only paying lip service, if that, to renewable energy sources. So we are in a similar position to you, really, let's be frank. And what we need to do is educate our politicians. And I always think of your wonderful President Jefferson, who said a most profound thing. He said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And that's really what we're on about with this radio show, that everyone needs to learn this stuff and understand it deep in their bones and do something about it. And you know what? Just a few people can turn a country upside down. And I guess if we look at what Obama has done, Barack Obama, one man who rose from nowhere and has charisma and power and the intelligence to bring people together, you know, each of us can actually be capable of doing that, Kevin. Don't you agree?
Yeah, well, Obama just clinched the Democratic nomination for president last night, and he's got a real good shot at winning. And he has taken a firm stand against the Yucca Mountain Project. He said that he will withdraw the application if elected president. So that's a big distinction between him and McCain. McCain's a big supporter of Yucca Mountain. You were right about the nuclear power question. Obama's gotten a lot of money from Exelon, the biggest nuclear utility in the country. But we're going to work really hard to educate him. And there's a phenomenon going on. I mean, we've lived through the Iraq War debacle in this country. Obama was smart enough before it started to oppose it, like millions of Americans were as well. So we're really hopeful that some good can happen in the near future. There's tremendous renewable energy potential in the U.S.
Yeah.
And you inspired Dr. Arjun Makajani to write the book Carbon Free and Nuclear Free by 2050, a roadmap for U.S. energy policy. And there is a tremendous buzz, not only in Washington, D.C., but across the country, especially at the grassroots level, about this book and its findings. Dr. Makajani has run the math. He has impeccable technical credentials, and he firmly believes and documents that we can phase out nuclear power and fossil fuel use and still power the U.S. economy through energy efficiency and renewables by 2050 and reduce carbon emissions in the United States by close to 100%.
That's correct. Well, we can do it. All right, Kevin, maybe you need to run for Congress, huh?
Well, I'm happy that one of my mentors back home in Michigan is actually running against one of the most pro-nuclear members of Congress. So we are. Our movement is trying to get into Congress, and he just gave a anti-nuke and pro-renewable speech up in Michigan a week ago, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, I'll be back in America in October, but also probably next spring. And, you know, maybe we can work together and go to communities and turn people on. But, you know, people should be thinking of running for Congress. I'm really deadly serious about this. That's a bad pun, deadly serious, but I am. And you're a beautiful, handsome fellow, you know, and that does a lot for media when you're running for a political office, but also you're highly intelligent, Kevin, and you're right on the right track. So think about it seriously, all right?
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
There are some exciting candidates running this time around. There's three Senate candidates who would replace pro-nuclear members, so that's
good.
Exciting as well. There's some good things.
Yep. Well, let's all work together and put our money where our mouth is. You know, let's really save the planet, and it's America that has to lead the way. Now, I want to thank Kevin Camps from the bottom of my heart. Thank you so much for coming on today. Kevin's a radioactive waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear. And maybe we'll see each other in October, Kevin.
I sure hope so. And thank you for founding our organization and for all you do.
That's a pleasure, Kevin. My guest today was Kevin Camps, a radioactive waste watchdog and specialist at Beyond Nuclear, an organization based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. For more information on what we've been discussing, go to beyondnuclear.org. We rely on donations from our listeners to keep this show on air, so if you'd like to contribute, please go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org. ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Do you love this planet? That was Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears. Thank you for listening to If You Love This Planet. Make sure you tune in next week because my guest will be Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, columnist, and best-selling author of No Logo, and more recently, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, which is a most profoundly important book. So tune in and hear Naomi next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is recorded at 2XX FM Community Radio in Canberra, Australia, and produced by Scott Powell, Amanda Bellerby, and Jasmine Williams. For more information on this program, to listen to previous shows, or to make a donation, visit our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org.